Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Copycats last night, Alfred, with guns.
Why don't you hide them and take the weekend off?
That wasn't exactly what I had in mind when I said I wanted to inspire people.
I know. But things have improved. Look at the new district attorney.
I am closely. Need to know if he can be trusted.
Are you interested in his character or his social circle?
Rachel spends her time with it's her business.
I trust you don't have me followed on my day off.
You ever took one, I might.
Know your limits, Master Wayne.
Batman has no limits.
Well, you do, son.
Well, can't afford to know them.
And what's going to happen on the day that you find out?
We all know how much you like to say, I told you so.
On that day, Master Wayne, even I won't want to. Probably.
The biggest movie of the year just opened, and the Movie Geeks United crew are here to discuss it with you and amongst ourselves. The whole crew's here. Myself, I'm Jamie, and Jerry and Chris are here with us too. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hey, what's up? And by the way, we're not talking about the biggest movie of the year anymore. We're talking about the biggest movie of all time, as far as opening goes, anyway.
That's true. Good point.
As one would expect, a record smasher, The Dark Knight was. But, you know, they put a little asterisk there beside the gross, and they say that it still didn't – that's what they're saying. That it still didn't sell as many tickets as Spider-Man 3.
Really?
Because the cost of tickets have gone up. So, of course – and they said it sold about 200,000 less than Spider-Man 3, which is odd. I thought that was odd.
Can I just add this, though?
Yeah.
I remember every frame of The Dark Knight. I barely remember any frame of
Spider-Man 3. I know. But not 200,000. I'm sorry, that's way off base. But a few thousand less. But let's talk about this. Obviously, it's a big sensation, and I think it's going to outrun every movie this year. And I think it's going to, in terms of gross, I think it's going to come closest to Titanic's gross out of any movie that's come since. That's my opinion on it. What do you guys feel about that? And just in terms of gross, and then we'll talk about quality of film.
Okay, you think it's going to outgross Beverly Hills Chihuahua? I'm joking, no. I don't think any film will come close to this.
Right.
I don't think anything will come. The only two films that have a chance to come close to this, in all seriousness, are Quantum of Solace and Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. I think those can come close. I'm not saying they'll beat it, but I think they can come close.
Right.
But I think this film, by next weekend, we're looking at $250-300 million at least.
Yeah, I think we're looking at that definitely. That's a fair assessment. In terms of Quantum of Solace and Harry Potter, I don't even think that they'll make up to the amount of money Indiana Jones has made. But.
I think they'll make more than it's really funny. You want to say Indiana Jones, say Indiana who?
Right. Indiana Jones seems so – the buzz about Indiana Jones seems so irrelevant now that the buzz on this has paid off so much.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the actual film, enough about money. Obviously, this thing's guaranteed a boatload.
Yeah.
When did you guys see it? What kind of audience did you guys see it with, first of all?
Chris, I I went and saw it on Friday night, the primetime show, which is notoriously a bad time to go see, especially a PG-13 movie. Probably the last 10 PG-13 movies I saw on a Friday night primetime. The right. audience was just horrible. Even if it was a good movie, there was talking and chattering. Honestly, I did not hear one person talking in the theater. Everybody was so anxious for it to start. I showed up 45 minutes early, and there was a line around the corner already. So, you know, I mean, it was a dream crowd to watch the movie with. It was perfect.
Isn't that nice? I felt the same way because like Jerry, I believe, I mean, you saw it at Midnight Thursday show, the first show that they had.
Yeah, and every screen was sold out, but it was a peaceful crowd. I was really worried it was going to be just like a nightmare. But
right.
We got there. The guy told us to get there 2 hours ahead of time, which we did, and it was peaceful. It was so every like 11 screens were sold out, and but it was one of the everyone was quiet during the movie.
Yeah, it's almost like they knew going in that it was almost a sacred experience.
It is a sacred experience.
It felt like that, and nobody wanted to ruin anything for anyone, especially themselves. So it was very respectful and quiet, which was a great relief. I knew from the very first frame that we were dealing with a great film and a great filmmaker. I mean, obviously, we all know Christopher Nolan's a great filmmaker, but just from that very first frame and the power of the imagery of Chicago, I was taken by, and that was really the first thing that took me by the movie is how well Chicago plays a role in this film. You know, it feels tangible. It doesn't feel like an artificial Gotham. It feels real and imposing because it is. They really use the Chicago architecture to a great degree. We don't need to nitpick. Let's just say what overall we felt about the movie. Chris, if you want to start out, because I know that you love it just as we do, and it's just varying degrees of love.
I think essentially we're all on the same page here. I thought it was dynamite. Like Jerry was saying, you know, hype is one thing, and we see what that can do with something like Indiana Jones, but this thing does live up to the hype around it. Now, I personally don't like it quite as much as Batman Begins, but the way I put it is there's every superhero movie ever made, and then there's the two Chris Nolan Batman films are in another universe, a completely separate universe from anything, even the X-Men movies, which are pretty good, and the Hellboy movies, which are pretty good. These are in another world, and in that world, I just prefer the first one. But that's not saying that this movie isn't clearly the best movie of the year so far. One of the, you know, second best action superhero movie that I've ever seen. And I would, you know, he's going to have to really try hard to top himself if he does come back and make a third film, because it was, from start to finish, pretty incredible. Although I do think that the third act, it sort of falls apart in the third act. That's why Batman Begins.
You have the same opinion about Batman Begins, though, didn't you? The climax of the film was a little off.
Well, yeah, I still think that there's an action sequence there that's going on, and it's not the third act of Batman Begins that I don't like. It's just the roaring train into Wayne Tower that I wasn't crazy about. This one, I thought that I didn't really buy the transition of Harvey Dent's character. I didn't really find the boat, the two ferry boat, that whole sequence. I didn't think that completely worked. But I went and saw it again today for a second time, and actually the third act played better the second time around watching it. But, yeah, I do think that it falls apart a little bit in the third act. That said, it's got a good first act, and the second act, the middle, about an hour portion in the middle of the movie, is so frickin' good that you can't, you can forgive, you know, little stuff that I'm not crazy about, like the transition of the Harvey Dent character. There's about an hour of this movie that is unlike anything you've ever seen, and even Batman Begins doesn't have a straight hour like that in it. So,
right.
Yeah, I loved it. I thought it was really great. Obviously, Heath Ledger, you know, what can you say? I have problems with the Harvey Dent character, but I like Aaron Eckhart. The Joker, I have no problems with how that character was handled. I loved it, and his performance is leaving some big clown shoes for somebody to step in if they dare.
I don't think anyone's going to dare for a long time.
In terms of Harvey Dent, do you feel like, I mean, the movie's obviously long enough, but do you feel like it was something left on the editing room where it felt, this is how I felt a little bit, I mean, that it felt a little truncated, like maybe there was a connective tissue missing somewhere, because it seemed very abrupt, especially him at the end taking Gary Oldman's family by, I mean, it didn't seem conducive to, it didn't play.
Exactly. It's believable, maybe. I just don't think that they established a real enough relationship between he and Maggie Gyllenhaal, that maybe that was to do with the chemistry between the two actors. Maybe they could have had some more scenes really establishing. You got the idea that she really was in love with him at the very end of the movie. I didn't really get the idea that he was so in love with her that he would go. Maybe he would go after the people, the dirty cops that were responsible for her death. It didn't feel believable to me that when he went after Gary Oldman's family, that whole part where he turns into a villain, you know, and not just a vigilante, that didn't quite work for me. But again, you've got this Dynamite hour that you've just sat through. I mean, Dynamite 2 hours, really, that you've just sat through, and I'm willing to let it go and say, you know, it's a superhero world, and I'll go with it.
Yeah, you and I were talking last night, and I knew that you said it was fantastic, but with reservation, I had no argument. I mean, I have no problem at all with your insights. You know, it wasn't something that we're coming from a completely different place in terms of the little faults in the movie. But I said it was almost like picking a flea off a whale. I mean,
whale. If I was not.
Yeah, the movie is so damn good that for the large part, the little flaws in don't matter so much. I mean, they don't take away from the whole experience of it.
Not at all. They don't take away at all.
I don't think that it changes the movie. I just state those reasons as to why I prefer the Batman Begins story. I just prefer the origin story of how this man became, you know, I mean, that character, Bruce Wayne, goes through a major life shift and decides to do something just like Harvey Dent. And it took a whole movie to explain how he went through that kind of life transition, whereas Harvey Dent sort of does it, you know, inside of about 30 minutes.
Bought that in that regard, Chris. I bought that because the Harvey Dent character in this film in relation to Bruce Wayne, because Bruce Wayne is the vigilante, and I like how these two films emphasize the vigilante aspect as none of the other films have. But Harvey Dent's like this almost, when he goes through the transformation, the Two-Face, it's like, well, I'm going to do this better than you, Bruce, because you don't like to kill people. I'm going to kill people because I've lost the love of my life. I don't really care anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like he's like saying, you know, you won't cross this line, Bruce, but I'm going to cross this line and do it better than you ever could. And I think that's what I like about Harvey Dent, is they don't portray him as really as a villain as they did in Batman Forever or as in the comics or even as in the old TV show. They portray him basically as this very tragic version of Bruce Wayne who's not afraid to cross the line.
But I think he agrees with it. I think we all agree with that. I think the only complaint is that in order for that to come across, for that to work, you have to really feel like the sun rises and sets with her in his eyes.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I agree 100%, Jerry, with what you're saying.
Feel it's explained in the film enough.
No, I mean, I don't feel that connection was palpable between the two of them. Like, this, I believe it from her because, you know, he had the note and everything, and she's talking to Bruce Wayne about it. It didn't really come across from his side. I mean, it
from
does a little
side.
Bit.
Right.
I just feel like that's such a major transition for this character that we love so much, and we love him because he's like Gordon and Bruce Wayne or Batman. He wants to do the right thing no matter what. We love him so much. That, like, major transition for him didn't seem justified given what the movie said. Again, though, like Jamie's saying, this complaint that I have about the movie is minor. I'm willing to let that little thing go. That, you know, it's just easy for me to point out these things out because I'm something of a contrarian, and you know, everybody's you know, like, freaking out about this movie and saying how great it is, and it is. But my gut reaction is to say, yeah, it's great, but you know, there's a little hole here. But it doesn't mean that I won't be the first person online to buy this movie when it comes out on DVD.
Exactly.
I've seen it twice in the last 2 days, for God's sake. I mean, I love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Here's a little clip, and then, Jerry, you're on, and let's get your initial takes on this film.
Okay.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment. I only have one question. Where is Harvey Dent? You know where Harvey is? You know who he is?
Do you know where I can find Harvey? I need to talk to him about something. Just something little,
huh?
No. You know, I'll settle for his loved ones.
We're not intimidated by thugs.
You know, you remind me of my father. I hated my father.
Yeah, any discussion of what's great about The Dark Knight, I mean, it has to start with Heath Ledger. I mean, am I right? Yeah.
Tell
me about your experience. Yeah.
He is chilling, and the way he's introduced into the story is brilliant. And you sort of know he's there, but you don't know how, but that bank robbery sequence is just great, and I think it also just sets up the, and using the school bus, too, that was just the icing on the cake. But Ledger, his take on the Joker is by far the best. His take on a comic book villain is the best. His take on a villain is the best because, guess what? He doesn't care about money. He doesn't care about revenge. He is only concerned with causing trouble, chaos, anarchy. He is a very dangerous fiend.
Yeah.
I mean, he is absolute terror. Now, there have been analogies to Hannibal Lecter and even either version, Robert Mitchum or Robert De Niro, Max Cady. I feel safer in the room with any of those three guys than I do with Heath Ledger's Joker. I really don't know how I could, you know, the Joker does not care about anything. He is only interested in setting the world afire.
Yeah.
And he is truly terrifying. That cackle, forget Nicholson and Romero's cackle. This one will just, live in your nightmares forever.
Yeah. So
it's
a
brilliant film.
So what struck you about it? What are the main points that you'd like to bring across of why it's such a sensational, effective movie?
First and foremost, I actually think this film, if you're not a comic book fan, will work better for you.
Yeah.
This is not a comic book film. This transcends the genre first and foremost. Second of all, having said that, though, we're dealing with a gentleman, Mr. Nolan, and his brother, who respect the material so much, but they put their own spin on it, and they did something rather unique. I don't think of all the pseudo-political films we've seen the last couple of years, I think this is the first film to actually deal with what we're going through really well. This is a brilliant allegory for the war on terror, for the terrorism age. You're watching this and you're like, oh my God, they're dealing with electronic eavesdropping in one scene. They're dealing with waterboarding. They're dealing with all this torture and everything. You're like, my God, and it works. In all the genres you can think of, this is the one place where it works. And you're just dumbfounded.
That's just that, you know, they, in their attempts, and we knew this, we got this drift from the last show, the last film, in their attempts to make it more realistic, more real world, they are pulling in all of these, where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the Joker, the anarchist, the guy that doesn't care about anything. He just wants to watch it burn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we heard that from, not to point the finger where everyone else is, but from the terrorists that they just want to destroy us. You know, they don't want to negotiate. They don't want money. They're not afraid to, and all those little references from real world show up in this movie in terms of the surveillance, Big Brother, and to do good, what kind of shortcuts you need to take, and if it's worth it in the end,
right?
You know, like the surveillance plot line in it,
yeah.
And so many other elements of it.
And Lucius is our conscience when it comes to that. He's like the, you know, he wants not. He's really appalled by that scenario. And I
yeah.
think what I love about this film, what I love about Nolan, is he is where Burton and especially Schumacher just wrote off a lot of these minor characters. He is given, well, I didn't even think Lucius Fox was in any of the previous films before Begins, but he's given him, Alfred, and especially Gary Oldman, they're like the
yeah.
voice of conscience in this. They're like, you know, they're saying what, you know, they're saying the things that are in our minds, you know, about what's right and wrong. I think, and this is a spoiler, folks, so tune out if you want. I think this, the conversation that Gary Oldman has with his son at the very end of the film sums up who and what Batman is to all
yeah.
of us. That last 5 minutes when he's telling his son about Batman is beautiful, tragic, but beautiful, but very real.
Yeah.
And I was very touched by that.
And no one is wasted here, I didn't think. You know, and that's always the problem for me in superhero movies where there's so many characters going around. Somebody's going to get short shrift and you're going to feel it and the movie's going to suffer for it. I felt that everyone came across. I thought that everyone was given an important piece of business that was very relevant to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that about Bruce Wayne, too. I liked his arc. I liked the take on the vigilante aspect and what it would inspire. You know, the copycats, people turning against him,
mm-hmm.
the villains coming out to play, and they're more harsh than ever. I liked where they took everything, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly confident piece of filmmaking. And Chris, you and I were talking yesterday. Even the supporting characters, we were reveling in the bit parts.
I know you and I were talking a lot about Eric Roberts, who is great.
Mm-hmm.
Great to see him in a like nice little juicy role, which he chews up pretty well. And actually, I was, the second time, I was really taken with William Fichtner, who's a really fine actor, and he always shows up in interesting performances
yeah.
and things like Go and shows like Prison Break.
Mm-hmm.
He usually plays a heavy or a cop or something like that. And again, here he's playing kind of a heavy bank manager type, and he's just really funny in the 2 minutes on screen that he has. He really chews it up.
Mm-hmm. He does.
Pretty fun and pretty exciting. I like all those little moments in Anthony Michael Hall. The only one I had a problem with was Tiny Lister. I wasn't happy about his little piece in the movie there. But,
but can I, speaking of that, though,
I thought that was
I was surprised by that sequence, though. I thought, because given the tone of the movie up till that point, I was surprised by the actions on both ferries.
Hmm. You thought the ferry thing worked very well, didn't you, Jerry?
Oh, I thought it. Let's put it like this. It surprised me, which is very hard to do for me, because I was given the way the movie is going up to that point, you're like, oh, great. But it
yeah.
did surprise me, and I really was impressed with that. Not, you know, when you see Tiny, you know, you do expect the worst. But I was surprised by that part of the film.
Yeah, I can't say I was really surprised by it. I just didn't think that sequence worked. The movie can be broken up into segments, essentially,
mm-hmm.
which are like the Joker's kind of ruse that he's. That he's throwing down. And in that way, it is very similar to, I just mean in terms of setup, like the Saw movies. He is kind of like that character. He's setting these things up, and everyone else sort of has to deal with this chaos that is in his wake, you know? And
yeah.
that particular little compartmentalized sequence, I didn't think quite worked for me. But, you know, I've heard both sides of it.
I think for me, what this movie brings about is, take the other Batman movies, take every comic book movie made, and I've said this to both of you many times, it just makes you realize how limited their imagination was in those films. I mean, obviously the first Batman is a completely different creature than this one. The closest analogy that I can make for it and Chris, I made it to you last night, is Burton's Batman has eyes, and this Batman has eyes and a brain, you know, as opposed to, you know, Burton is surface, this one is depth.
That's very funny.
Yeah. So...
The way that was phrased was very funny.
They actually were showing the other Batman movies on TNT today, and it's funny because I saw a little piece of Batman Forever right before I left for the movies. And when I got back, Batman and Robin was on it. And I watched a little piece of them.
Oh, it's
just for amusement's sake. They were bad 3 weeks ago, you know, before we'd seen this thing.
Right.
Now they're like something else. I mean, they look like some sort of experiment gone wrong. It's really, really funny. In fact, I recommend everyone go out and rent the two Schumacher films, especially because they're so different to watch now. It's like another world.
Oh,
you know?
I agree, Chris. I just have to say, I like Tim Burton a lot, but I don't think he comes into his stride really as a filmmaker until he teams up with Johnny Depp. I think these films, you know, his films are visually and are good, and I think the sad thing about his films is Michael Keaton did a great job, but never got the credit he deserved because he was always overshadowed by these villains that were just such overkill. But let me tell you, with Batman Begins, and especially with this one, Christopher Nolan has erased whatever has come before him.
Yeah,
I can't go back and ever watch those films ever again.
I really think you should.
I can't watch them like with a straight face.
I mean today, with your Dark Knight glasses on, watch them again, and it's quite a sight, actually.
Yeah.
It's a whole different universe, like I was saying before. It's something else.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that did prepare me, and for those that haven't seen it yet, I hope we haven't ruined anything for you, but the thing that prepares you the most, at least for me, in terms of the approach of this movie, is it is more akin to an epic crime saga than it is your typical comic book movie.
Absolutely.
You know, and people are bringing up Heat and Godfather 2, and that's fine. I think it lacks the poetry of those movies. But at the same time, I mean, this is the top of one of the top comic book movies ever made. It's the best movie one of the best movies so far this year, if not the best. And it's reason to get excited. I mean, finally, a movie lives up to its buzz. And when was the last time that happened?
It's been a while. The only one I can think of that lived up to its buzz in a way is the Iron Man movie.
Yeah,
but that was the antithesis of this. That was a lot of fun, and that was really, I have to say, because of Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
We might not be talking about that movie had someone else played Iron Man.
And actually, I think that movie, it did have buzz because it's a superhero movie, but it was more even of a surprise because there was nothing before it.
Right.
But yeah, in terms of this year, I'd say that movie lives up to what we expect of it. But this movie, I think what Jamie maybe means is like that we've been kind of awaiting this thing for 2 years now. Well, longer than that, really, 3 years, I guess, since the first Batman. But since they've been in production and we started hearing, who are they going to get to play the Joker? Is it going to be, you know, people talked about Sean Penn and Crispin Glover. And
that's right.
Out of nowhere came Heath Ledger. And at first everybody was like, what? And then it was like, okay, you know, maybe that could work. And, wow, I mean, did it work? I can't imagine anyone else playing that part now. I can't even, you know. I grew up watching Jack Nicholson do it. You know,
right.
I probably saw the 89 Batman 1,000 times when I watched it over and over again, and it's gone from my memory now. It's just completely gone.
Okay. Let me ask you this, though. It's obviously the obvious question. There's no right or wrong answer to this question, but what if he had not died? Do you think we would still be talking about his performance?
That's interesting, and I haven't really heard a lot of people talking about that, but honestly, I think yes, I think we would. I think it's that kind of performance. I really do.
I think you're right.
Going into the movie, I know most people that saw it thought, ooh, is it going to be weird watching Heath Ledger on screen? Is it going to be strange knowing that he died, that this is basically the last movie that he completed? Is that going to affect how I watch it? And as I'm watching the movie the first time, mostly I was just smiling every time he came on screen. You get this excitement whenever the Joker is on screen, and actually that excitement carries over into the rest of the movie because there's this, like, tension that maybe he will show up. And actually, scenes that are not as dynamic as maybe they would be in a totally different Batman movie are made more dynamic because there's this feeling like maybe Heath Ledger will show up, you know, maybe the Joker will show up.
Right.
It's pretty incredible. The second
time watching it, I did
have a little moment when he's, you know, at the end of the movie on his final, because, you know, obviously the second time watching it, you know which scene is his final scene. And watching that the second time, I did get a little bit emotional.
Right.
You know, I mean, I wasn't crying or anything, but I was just sort of saying to myself, wow, that's, you know, basically the last time we'll see him in this dynamic role, you know, hanging there. And
right.
Pretty incredible, pretty amazing. I think it will be remembered that way.
Yeah, and when he's hanging there, he says so many things that are essential truths about his relationship to Batman and just about Batman. It's haunting, it's touching, it's all this, but he basically, it's almost like it's like a psychoanalysis session, but he gets it and he understands. They're like, they have this understanding of each other that, you know, it's heartbreaking to watch, but it's moving. But they just say these things to each other. But it's the Joker who really understands Batman more than anyone.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Batman says nothing because he knows that he knows.
Yeah.
He's right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in terms of the Heath Ledger factor, I'm sure everybody's been talking about how much of this, the attendance and the buzz of this movie has to do with him, simply for the virtue that, you know, he's no longer with us. And there's no way to scientifically break that down. But for me, watching it, I didn't see Heath Ledger. It was a completely new performance. It could have been anybody under that makeup. I did not see Heath Ledger. So for me, it was not a stumbling block, and it was not a factor in watching the movie for me. He disappeared.
Mm-hmm, he does.
Yeah, it's an amazing performance. I mean, in a different way than Aaron Eckhart's performance is. For me, the Heath Ledger performance in The Joker, it's almost akin to what Johnny Depp does. He takes outside influences and builds a full character from it. I said, I'll take this person's voice, I'll take this mannerism, this person's mannerisms, you know, like a mad scientist or something. And
right.
It feels like that kind of role, very exciting. Aaron Eckhart, he has a more classic gives a more classically excellent performance because he has the arc, he has an emotional journey that he goes through. I think all the performances are just exceptional in this movie.
They are.
But obviously, I mean, like Nolan said, Ledger is the shark in Jaws in this movie. He just slices through mercilessly.
Mm-hmm.
And the villains always give the most attention, you know. But I thought he was just exceptional, and I was surprised that he didn't take it further. And that's not a criticism because I was happy. It almost felt like a restrained performance in a way, because you know he could have like filled it with ticks and stuff, but it felt like he picked just the right moments. It wasn't overkill. He felt like a real villain. He didn't feel like a caricature.
So
yeah, and Chris
so
and I were talking about that the other night. Yeah. That's the genius of that performance. I think the first genius of it was in the conception of it. And the execution was just icing on the cake. It was beautiful.
Yeah, it's never overkill. It's never like, you know, with my, you know, the Jack's Joker in Batman is Jack. It's Jack. I mean, it's Jack of the Witches of Eastwick, The Shining. It's Jack playing.
And that's
Jack.
What you wanted. I mean,
really, you know, that's what you're getting with that performance. But here.
Yeah.
And there's a scene. There's a little scene I love when he leaves the hospital and he's trying to, you know, get the detonator to work. You know, he's in the nurse's uniform, and there's just little touches like that I love. I just think are classic.
Chris,
yeah,
before you go, because I know you got to take off soon. Tell me your favorite scene, favorite moment from the movie.
Somebody asked me that earlier today, and I don't really. I mean, obviously that middle. Sequence there, that middle hour, it really is like an hour of film time there that's so, so great. But for me, my favorite shot really is the end of that sequence, basically, when the Joker escapes from the jail and he hangs his head out the window and the sound in the movie sort of drops out and you just have that sort of like droning noise quality that's left in, like in a David Lynch movie. And he's shaking his head, you know, violently like a mad dog out the window. And you just realize what an unstoppable, chaotic force this guy is, and he's just tearing the city apart. And it's just exhausting for everyone that is involved with him, everyone in the city. For me, is the moment in the movie that the second time also really just... And again, the entire audience felt that way because, as you know, you go see a movie, and a movie has a moment of silence, and you can hear people wrestling with their candy or coughing or chatting or, you know, getting up to do something. No, this moment of silence, in the middle of this two-and-a-half-hour epic movie, there's no talking. People are completely in the palm of Chris Nolan and Heath Ledger and everyone else's hand. People are just spellbound, myself included.
I'm glad you brought that up because the sound design is amazing. And there's that almost metallic sounding. It starts from silence and then, you know, and it almost feels like There Will Be Blood. It has that same kind of effect where it unnerves you. It's this ever-increasing kind of metallic sound that just gets to you, and it is haunting. And I think that the film editing, for the most part, is exceptional, too. I'm thinking about the cross-cutting between, like, three separate places where they find three different traces of DNA on this card, and they're trying to save these three different people. And it's cutting back and forth so confidently, and it keeps you engrossed. You're not confused. It's beautifully done. Chris, when you need to leave, just let me know.
Yeah, well, I'm going to a dinner with my mother-in-law here, so I'll go ahead and dip out. But I was glad to talk about this movie with you guys, and I'm glad we all enjoyed it so much. Rarely happens on this level. In fact,
very rarely.
Yeah.
Thank you, buddy.
I'm glad you were here, Chris. Thank you.
Likewise.
You have a good night, buddy.
Later.
Bye bye. Jerry, favorite moment?
Oh God, favorite moment. How about favorite sequence when they're transporting Aaron Eckhart? That whole chase sequence.
Oh yeah.
I love to. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time during that. And when the bat thing turns into the bat pod, the bat cycle, I was like, oh yes. Bring it on.
That was a moment of real, like, adrenaline, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Euphoria.
I mean, ask my mom. She'll tell you, this kid was on the edge of his seat, just he couldn't stop.
And the truck flips over. I laughed out loud when the truck flipped over.
Yeah.
It was such a... for me, like, I have a... the movie's filled with such great imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the oddest image, it almost looked like... It looked so odd. Was the image of Heath Ledger walking out of the hospital and that hobbling in that nurse's uniform.
Mm-hmm.
It was just such an odd, first of all, an odd look for him. Like, and the composition was just beautiful.
Yeah,
like
it was.
Some kind of weird painting or something. That's an image that just sticks in my mind out of the entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
I was
so
taken by that.
It really does. No doubt. It was like someone that I had read somewhere, someone had compared it to almost a Charlie Chaplin-esque moment when he was doing that. And that's fair. That's definitely fair and appropriate.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. That's true. And that's part of what that hobble, that limp that he has, like, made it even more odd in that nurse's uniform.
Mm-hmm.
We want to hear from you guys. The number to call into the show is 718-508-9477. We want to hear your take on it. We got about a little over 20 minutes to hear from you, so call in. Let us know what you think, and let's start a dialogue with our listeners now about Batman. Here's another scene in the meantime from it. Let me see. Let me make sure this is one that I haven't played yet.
Okay.
Did you get mauled by a tiger?
That's the one I already played. Here's one that I haven't played yet.
Okay.
this is actually a great scene of the movie.
It took me 3 weeks to get a reservation here, and I had to tell them I worked for the government.
Really?
The city health inspector's not afraid to pull strings.
Rachel, fancy that.
Yeah, Bruce, fancy that.
Rachel, Natasha, Natasha, Rachel.
Natasha, are you the
Prima ballerina for the Moscow Ballet?
Wow, Harvey's taking me next week.
Really? So you're into ballet?
Bruce, this is Harvey Dent.
The famous Bruce Wayne. Rachel's told me everything about you.
I certainly hope not. So let's put a couple tables together.
I'm not sure that they'll let us.
Oh, they should. I own the place.
That was great.
in those scenes, and what I like in the first half of the movie is they emphasize his playboy mentality.
Yeah.
You know, and also Batman Begins did that as well. None of the films, well, you could make an argument. No, not even the one with Clooney emphasized it, really. But I like how they emphasize that and they use it as a cover for his mission to Hong Kong in this one.
Right.
And I like that. I like seeing that side of him because we don't get to see that much. And I thought it was very clever. It was a nice touch.
I think so, too. And I think that, if you think, excuse me, I'm eating coleslaw. I think, I thought, can I wait to eat dinner until after the show? And I was so hungry, and I thought, no, I might as well get it. I think that, if anything, Christian Bale is not going to receive the praise he deserves in this. I think that, first of all, Batman is a very, especially when he's surrounded by colorful villains, very difficult and thankless part, almost, because his Bruce Wayne has to be a blank slate, you know?
Yeah.
And actually, the set designer talked about the difficulty. I think they transformed some kind of bank lobby or something into his penthouse for the movie. He said the challenge of it.
Yeah.
He said the challenge of it was making it colorless, like there could be no fixtures that spoke of any personality traits that he had at all. And the one thing that I don't like about their take on Batman, I know it's conducive to the whole, let's do it realistically as possible, is when he's in the suit and he plays that play voice that he does.
Yeah, they still need to work on that.
It feels like, all right, now I'm going to play the bad guy. This is my alter ego. And yeah, but, you know, that expensive suit, it seems like they could have some kind of voice altercation thing that made it a little more believable.
Mm-hmm.
Than a guy playing dress-up. I just can't take the voice seriously.
Hey, it sounds like Clint Eastwood gargling, like, mouthwash, you know, during some
exactly.
of that scene. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know. But they, like you said, these are minor complaints to an overall truly masterful film.
I think so, too. And, you know, if we're talking about a third Batman in the Nolan canon, I'm of the opinion, and I talked to Chris, and he said the same thing. I think he should leave it alone. And I think my impression of him is that he will, unless he feels like he can do it just as well, if not better.
Well, that's the thing. I agree with you 100% there. But you know, Warner Brothers,
or any of these,
they're gonna ask someone. If Nolan's not gonna do it, they're gonna ask someone else to do it. Let me just throw this out, and it's a crazy idea. It's a crazy idea I've had since I guess the late 80s, early 90s. Stay away from it for 10 years. Bring everyone back and do Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns when Batman's older and he's been gone for a long time. And try that, maybe, or something along those lines.
Right.
But... you know, I agree with you. I don't know how you top this. I just don't know how you do this.
Now, I am sure there is going to be another Batman.
Oh,
anything that grosses $156 million in 3 days, there's going to be another one of.
Yeah.
I'm just talking about Nolan's involvement in it. I think his artistic integrity is such that he said, "I didn't want to make The Dark Knight unless I could improve upon the original." That's where he's coming from. So I doubt his involvement unless he can really knock it out of the park like he did this time.
Yeah, I don't trust the property under anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be very honest with you. I don't, and I think I've read in the chat room, and it's true. You know, if Nolan's not going to come back, I don't think anyone. There's a lesson to be learned here recently when Bryan Singer jumped ship to do Superman and left the X-Men, which he had done a really good job with. There's a lesson to be learned with that, because what happened was the X-Men 3 movie was disappointing, but the Superman movie was disappointing too. But there's a lesson to be learned. If Nolan's not going to come back, no one should come back either, because it's not going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, history has just demonstrated that several times in the last decade. If he can't come back, then no one else, it's just not going to work.
I think the benefit of distance too helps.
Yeah.
I mean, Nolan had the Prestige in between his Batman films. He could return to the franchise with fresh eyes and do what he did, which is re-examine it, re-visualize it, refurbish it. You know, I think the difference of a couple of years before he even thinks about tackling another one would be beneficial. You know,
absolutely.
Yeah, because you see these people that, you know, like Sam Raimi, he's got to be exhausted. All he's been doing for the past 10 years is directing Spider-Man movies.
Yeah, and you know what? And I was surprised because, you know, I think I mentioned this to you last night, but even Batman Begins has three major villains in it. The Wilkinson character, Falcone, Ra's al Ghul, the demon, and Scarecrow. Three villains. You would think, if I was the screenwriter to Spider-Man 3, I would have watched that film to see how to handle all those villains. And especially now with The Dark Knight, anyone attempting to do multiple villains should really look how to do, you know, how it's done. But, you know, like you said, I do think there needs to be some distance. You know, you've made this masterpiece. Leave
right.
it alone for a couple of years.
Isn't it amazing how, too, that the wild, I'm sorry, I'm eating buffalo chicken now.
That's all right. It's your show. You can do whatever you want.
The people, the actors that we consider like over the top and crazy in this movie, at one time they were Gary Oldman and Eric Roberts. And here they seem very subdued.
Also, let's not forget Christian Bale from American Psycho. I mean, you know, there's only an E separating Bateman and Batman. But
Christian Bale hasn't necessarily built his career on extreme characters.
No one like Gary Oldman.
Oldman.
No, Gary Oldman. That was the beauty in Batman Begins. Yeah. He is Gotham City's only honest cop. And
Even more so here.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest delights of this movie was how they utilized Gary Oldman for me.
Yeah. I mean, here this guy he's played like Lee Harvey Oswald, Sid Vicious. Stansfield and the professional.
Dracula,
and he is, you know, the good cop in both films, and it's just like, you realize, and especially watching this film, you're just like, dude, Gary Oldman is just one of the best actors.
Yeah, he really is, and I mean, welcome back. I don't know that he's been gone, but he's been doing some movies that no one has seen for a while.
That's true.
He's been working, which is good. But yeah, he gives a great deal of integrity to this role, and he's not by no means drowned out by the crazier characters.
No.
So it's beautiful performances. It's a movie with lots to think about, lots to chew on.
Mm-hmm.
If you're so inclined, if you're not. It's still a ride of a movie with exciting action sequences, great looking movie, you know. And I think that it's a home run.
It is surprising though. Mm-hmm.
It's surprising though. Obviously, it's made a lot of money. It's a big franchise. It's got, you know, Batman. Batman itself is a big franchise, but it is a risk for a studio to invest $180 million in a movie so bleak.
That's
Don't you
true.
Think?
Oh, I'm not going to disagree with you there. That's a very huge risk in this day and age, but it paid off, and I'm sure there'll be copycats and that sort of thing. But it paid off here, and you know, I can't attest to the why that is. I do think I'm not. This is no way to belittle the film at all. I do think it has something to do, sadly, with Ledger's premature death.
The film. The film's bleakness has nothing to do with his death.
No. I'm just saying. No, I'm wondering. You know, this is what I wonder. That this film's. How should we say it? Like, I was excited long before that happened. When I saw that first trailer in front of I Am Legend. They should not have shown that trailer in front of I Am Legend because I couldn't stop thinking about The Dark Knight. But I do think for a little bit of this, I do think there is a small percentage of there is a morbid curiosity there. But I think that exits as soon as James Newton Howard's and Hans Zimmer's music starts. that right. beautiful Why So Serious, I think is the name of the piece, during the bank robbery.
Right.
And that all that exited my mind, and I won't lie to you, that exited my mind months ago when I started.
I think there is a more of a curiosity. I'm talking about the bleakness of the movie. I mean, it's intrinsic. I mean, it's in the movie's marrow.
Oh, you can't escape it. That's what Batman is. Here's the simple thing. I'm going to say, Batman is dark and bleak. It's just the way it is. You read the great graphic novels of the character; they're bleak. These are not. This is not Adam West material. Regardless of what that joke, it's not.
Yeah,
bad.
You see that. You see more and more material like this, and I think that's why Batman, for this time, is the quintessential superhero for this time.
I said it
back when the Superman Returns came out, and you know, obviously, you know, it was a little bit of a dud. Didn't perform like they thought it would. I think a lot of that has to do with Superman is an outdated character. He's a goody two shoes. He doesn't speak to where we are now at all.
Mm.
He's not representative of anything. He has no color. He's a blank slate. He's like, oh, how are we going to kill him? Oh, we'll pull out the kryptonite. You know,
it's a rehash of the previous films, which was surprising.
And I don't know their reticence to do what they've done with Batman and try to reimagine the character. I think they just have to completely do a rehaul on it from their imagination. I don't think they have an origin.
Yeah, let me say this about Superman, though. You can cut me off whenever you want. My problem with that, the Superman Returns, was they played it too serious. Superman's not supposed to be that serious. Bryan Singer's Superman takes itself way too seriously in the second half of the film.
Right.
And I think Spacey plays Lex Luthor just way too mean. I really miss the Hackman take on the character.
In terms of Superman, I think that they need to, before they reinvest in another Superman, they really need to consider that.
I think you're absolutely right.
It's a dead character for me. I mean, there's nothing to it, right? You know. We have a call. Excuse me. There go my buffalo chicken wings. We have a caller. 215 area code. Let me bring them up. I don't know why my switchboard isn't working. As soon as I get my switchboard working, we'll bring up the 215 caller.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I like Superman Returns. I won't lie to you. They're part. I love the scene where he comes back and he rescues the plane that Lois Lane's on. I think that there's some sequences in that movie that I think are beautiful. But I think
right.
as a whole, something's missing there. And let's be honest, the movie really is essentially Superman 3. It's
right.
like the other Superman, and that's what kind of irks me. It's only like takes place 5 years after Superman 2.
It's essentially Superman 3 with Kate Bosworth playing the Richard Pryor part. Okay, we lost the 215 caller. Let me say at the top of the hour, we're welcoming a special guest. We're very excited to welcome him on. But before we get to that, or any other callers, if you guys want to try your luck again. I don't know why my switchboard's not working. We recently, for those of you that didn't join our live show on Wednesday night, we had technical difficulties and we had to kind of redo it. But during the live show, I played a clip from an interview that is premiering on July 30th, Wednesday, 2 days before this gentleman's new movie, Swing Vote, comes out. And it's an interview with Judge Reinhold that we did. And I want to play this little teaser for you, in case you missed it, the live feed on Wednesday. This is Judge Reinhold talking about the possibility of a Beverly Hills Cop 4. I feel like we got a scoop, like a little mini scoop on our hands. And I want to play you guys this little clip here.
Well, Brett Ratner I like very much. We've met several times. He says that he appreciates my work. I don't know Lorenzo Di Bonaventura. I don't know if Eddie wants to completely scrap everything and start a new franchise and be more like Bruce Willis in the Die Hard movies. That's one rumor. I'm notoriously the last person they come to so they can say they're out. You know, we don't have any money left and, you know, we're sorry we don't have any time. So that's been the strategy. I don't know what's going to happen, but that's not unusual for me not to know.
Right.
I would love to see Eddie be especially now after Dreamgirls, he could be so exciting and dangerous, sexy, you know. And I'd love to see Rosewood on the bomb squad. It was such a mistake to have Rosewood climbing this bureaucratic ladder. Man, give the guy some heavy explosives. Let him blow up the wrong house, you know, the wrong building. It's dying to be done. I was so disappointed when they gave me that bureaucratic dead end job, you know.
Right.
And
right.
So, to answer your question, I would be dying to put it right. I'll be sad if the reason why Eddie comes back. Historically, Eddie has to come back to Beverly Hills to avenge somebody's death, and I hope it's not Billy that gets shot in the head. You know, I really hope that's not the case. I don't know that I would do that. I don't want to kill Billy off.
There's such a special chemistry between the two of you, though, and it really makes those films sing for me. So I think you're an invaluable contribution to those films. I can't imagine it without you.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. Anybody listening, write Paramount, because I'd love to be in the movie. I mean, it's not just... I want to put it right. I want to do it for Don Simpson. I want to do it for the right reasons. Hey, I want to make money, you know, but I don't want to end like that, you know?
Right, right.
I really don't. I want to bring it back. And the action comedy is a great genre when it's done right. When the mixture of true danger and true high stakes and comedy it's beautiful, you know? I loved it. I loved doing it, and I think we really achieved it in the first two. Anyway, Lorenzo Di Bonaventura is a very smart guy. He's a dark, edgy filmmaker, and I think that's what it needs. But obviously I'd like to be in it, but I want to blow some crap up, man.
It's about time.
I want to be in the bomb. They got to put me in the bomb squad, and I had this idea where maybe what brings them, instead of having me shot, why don't I get in over my head undercover where I've learned something that's true, but I'm way over my head with these guys, whoever they are, whether it's a terrorist plot or whatever, and I disappear, and he's got to come get me, and he takes care of business, you know.
I think you need to write your own draft, my friend.
I got 10 years of ideas that it's totally indiscreet talking about it on the air, but I don't know, you know. I hope I get the chance to give some ideas, because I've thought about it more than probably anybody.
Yeah,
not the movie, but in terms of what Billy would do.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'd love to see him on on one of those Segway bikes, too. What if he's a Segway bike cop? This guy's kill me.
Jeff Reinhold. It was a fantastic interview. As you could tell, he was very talkative and engaging. He was just a great, great guy. That interview, like I said, premieres live on the 30th, July 30th, next Wednesday. In terms of this coming Wednesday, we have a very special show. It's the first of a year-long series of shows paying tribute to the seminal films in Steven Spielberg's resume. And we're starting out, of course, with Jaws.
Can't wait.
So, Jerry, this is a fantastic show we got lined up.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific, we have special guests including Joseph McBride, who is Steven Spielberg's biographer, Wendy Benchley, the widow of Peter Benchley, who, of course, was the author of Jaws. We have two actors from the film, Susan Baccalini, who was in that infamous first scene where she got attacked by the shark at the very beginning, just one of the classic scenes of all time.
Yes.
Jeffrey Kramer, who played Scheider's deputy in the film. And we also have Carl Gottlieb, the screenwriter of Jaws, and he also portrayed, I believe, Meadows in the film. And on top of that, we have crew members from The Shark Is Still Working, the quintessential documentary on the legacy of Jaws.
I love that documentary. I've watched that, and I love that.
Fantastic, fantastic work. I put it in, like, all the time, and I watched it all the way through. I relished it that first time, and now I get doses of it, like, every day. I just put it in and give my Shark Is Still Working fix.
Yeah.
this is going to be a fantastic Wednesday night show. So I hope everyone can join us for it, because it's a great show and a great film. And packed, lots of guests. So join
us
for that.
It's a big show. I mean, if you really think about it, when I was thinking about it last night after you told me, I was like, wow, dude, that's an enormous show.
This has really turned into a behemoth.
It's as big as that shark.
I know. And just as merciless. So, and future movies, you know, we're talking about E.T., of course. I personally want to do something on Empire of the Sun, because it's a film that I love so much.
Speaking of Christian Bale, definitely.
The greatest child performance of all time, if you ask me. Christian Bale in that movie. Incredible. Amazing.
Wait, you don't think Jake Lloyd in Phantom Menace? No, I'm joking.
Listen to you.
I'm horrible.
What about Always?
What about Always?
Always, never. So we got some great shows coming up, and then we'll be back next Sunday, too. You know, twice a week, we're here for you.
Yeah, we're here, and you guys can call in. You do know that.
Yeah, let me check my switchboard. My switchboard hasn't been operating lately. We're waiting for our guests to call in. So let me refresh my switchboard real quick.
Yeah, you guys can call in. I mean, we really love to hear from you, really, all of you. And I'd love to hear from the futurists, although I realize that I may not want that after I get the call, but we love the futurists.
Right.
And we love
Olivia. Now, let's make it clear. The Dark Knight wasn't the only movie that came out this weekend. And actually, we talked about the bleakness of The Dark Knight. A complete contrast to that
is Mamma Mia, which I saw Friday afternoon.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
I want to ask you about that. Yeah.
Okay. It's some of the numbers are really good. I think it's a better trailer than it is a movie.
Really?
I mean, no. The last half hour is really good. You know who Colin Firth and Stellan Skarsgård are really good in it. It's the musical numbers, really, that are the best part. I could live without everything else, but I thought some of the numbers, especially in the second half, were actually really good.
Yeah.
But that's my take on Mamma Mia, the things I do for this show.
Right. Well, I really want to see Mamma Mia myself.
You should.
And everything that I've heard about it, I mean, and it's the reason why people love the musical, is simply because of, you know, imagine the music.
Yeah, the music is the, I mean, because the music, and, you know, here's the thing. People are like, oh, so embarrassed that they have the tune. All of us have these songs in our head. We know these songs. We've heard them in different places. But when you do hear them, you get to see Meryl Streep sing them, or Pierce, or Stellan, or it's fun.
Yeah, which is exactly what the movie's built to be. A good time. Yeah, make you sing down the aisles and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that in public naked. I think that that's the best way, actually.
Oh my God!
To express myself fully.
All right. Gary Busey is in the. They're talking about Gary Busey in the chat room. I don't know. That's kind of scary.
Gary Busey has some funny stuff on the internet now. Maybe we can talk about it in a little bit. But
okay.
Our guest is on the line. He's been waiting patiently. So let's do this. We are truly blessed to be joined now by a terrific up-and-coming filmmaker who we are honored to say is also a true and loyal fan of our show.
We love him.
Yes, yes. On a shoestring budget of $6,000, filmmaker Joel Valley has brought to the screen a sensational new film that has become a sensation throughout Mexico and beyond. His visceral and emotionally charged film is titled Corazón de Campeón. I love saying that. Thank you. I could just say the English translation, but I just love saying the title as it is.
You said that much better than I could have ever said it.
Thank you. Pass the Grey Poupon. And we are very pleased to have him with us tonight to tell us all about the film and his experiences working in the trenches of independent filmmaking. Please welcome to the show Joel Valley. Joel, are you with us, buddy?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, man.
Dude, it's so awesome to hear you finally.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
It's a treat, man. It's a treat, and especially after seeing your movie, I am thrilled to have you on the show to talk about it. So first of all, tell us about how the project came to be. Corazon de Campeón. It's based on a best-selling novel in Mexico, isn't it?
It's based on a book by a guy named John Varican, who goes all around the world, really, in Latin America, and he gives these conferences to the youth. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we
can hear you. Perfect.
Okay. So he decided he wanted to make a movie that had the same principles of his book.
Right.
So they were really well into it, actually making the movie by the time I got on board. What happened was I'd been making some short films, and I was at a party, and I was showing these short films, and the producer of the movie was there. Yeah. And he seen my short films, and he said, "Hey, why don't you come to this meeting? You know, we're filming a movie, and so you can give us some ideas, you know. I like what you do. I like your work. It looks great. Come and give some ideas." So I went, and I started giving some ideas, and I started to see what they had in mind. And I told them, "No, you can't do this. You're breaking this rule, and you're breaking this rule." Mm-hmm. And they had our director already, and it seemed kind of like I might have known a little more than what he might have known at the time. So I became the director, and he became the other director too, you know. And he was just—he had a good attitude about it. He wanted to learn from me, and so it was a good transition, and we worked really well together. So, and,
yeah. So how much was in the can before you came on board?
Nothing. They were. It was just like probably like a couple weeks before they were going to start shooting. Actually, so I said. And once I came on board, I took the whole script and I storyboarded every single shot that I needed, every shot that I wanted. And I had a huge red book, kind of like the Guillermo del Toro has his book. You know, I have my book as well. And I had all my shots in there, everything I wanted to do. We looked at it, and then we started filming. So that's how it came about. And it's been an amazing. You know, I had no idea what I don't think I knew what I was getting into at the time, but.
Well, yeah, we're gonna get into to that in just a little bit, because this is a huge success for you. But you mentioned Guillermo del Toro is when you're storyboarding and kind of crafting the look of this thing. Was he an influence his work, and were there any other influences that you used?
Oh, I got all kinds of influence. Obviously, del Toro, but I guess you know. It's no secret to say that my favorite director is Edgar Wright. Ever since he was doing Space out there in the UK,
right,
I became a total fan of his work. So, and you can see a lot of the influence of him in my movie, as well as like Robert Rodriguez. I kind of feel like because I'm a Chicano, which is I was born in the United States, but I've been in Mexico for a long, long time now, and that's
right.
Stuck in my talk English. This is actually my first English interview, so if I muck it up.
You're doing awesome, my friend. Joel, you're doing awesome. But I need to interject. What I liked about your film, Joel, and I do appreciate the introduction that you made for us, but more than that, what I liked about it, we up north do not get to see an authentic take on life and just situations in Mexico. We see a lot of stereotypical things, sadly.
Right.
So I really appreciated that.
Yeah.
I really.
And that's one of the things that I wanted to achieve with this film, because I think a lot of people from the U.S. who come and they come and visit me and stuff, and they're like, "Oh, you don't drive a donkey?" You know, they're like, you know, because Hollywood has painted this picture that everything here is cactuses and donkeys, and that's all we do, you know. And it's not like that. There's just beautiful places to film. There's just, I mean, you guys can see in my film, there are sand dunes, deserts, but there's cities, and there's big buildings, and there's just beautiful buildings, and you know, so a lot of I wanted to kind of show a little bit more, because I kind of figured this was going to end up being released in the United States one day, and I hope it does. So
yeah, so tell our audience, you mentioned the book, tell them a little bit about the story of the film.
Well, the film is seven stories in one, which is kind of a crazy project to take on when because it is my first movie. And I had like 46 speaking parts and some like 57, close to 60 locations for my first movie, which I don't know if I'd recommend to most first-time filmmakers. Luckily, we pulled it off.
But it was insane process to get it all done. I kind of drew a blank on what the question was. Sorry.
The plot of the film.
Oh yes. Sorry. Let's get back to the story, guys. Okay. The story is about it's 7 different stories, and they all kind of come together in the end. But it's basically about making the right decisions, because the guy who wrote the book and does the conferences, he can see that the youth is going downhill. I think it's pretty obvious to everyone that the youth are kind of they're going down fast. Their suicide rate is insane, and they just don't believe in themselves, you know. And it's about the choices people make in life. It really the base of it is a murder that happens in this town, and the choices that the people make based upon this murder, if you wanted to sum it up. So,
yeah.
But that's kind of the story, and I got to give credit to the script writer, Juan Carlos Garcia Quintero. He did a great job taking the principles out of the book and making it a script, because if you read the book and you read the script, it has nothing to do with each other.
Yeah.
But John, the guy who wrote the book, is going to do when he does his conferences, when you watch the movie, it was split up in 7 different sections. So one section plays, and then he comes on and he speaks. And then another section plays, and he comes on and he speaks. So
yeah.
And these conferences are like filled with like 6,000 to 7,000 to 8,000 teenagers at a time. The first time we did a test screening of my movie was in Lima, Colombia for 6,000. So that was a pretty good screening. And it wasn't the premiere. I just wanted to see what people liked about it, didn't like, what we needed to change, and all that good jazz. So.
Yeah, and then, like we said, this thing has been playing, your film has been playing in front of tens of thousands of people, and like you said, like 6,000 people a pop.
Yeah.
And it's tremendously successful, and I want to talk to you about that, but let's get back to the production of the film. I mean, this is, you talked about the amount of speaking parts and the ambition of the piece, and to be doing that on a shoestring budget, I'm wondering, were there any, when you evaluated the production, were there any sacrifices that needed to be made, and can you give me an example of any kind of creative compromises that you were forced to make in the process?
That whole movie is a creative compromise. I didn't have one dolly. I didn't have any dollies, and
really?
I don't think it's very. Yeah, I don't think it's obvious when you watch it.
No,
not at all.
Yeah, I did everything. A lot of the dolly shots that I would usually have a dolly, I did it on Steadicam.
Really?
I used the Steadicam. Yeah.
That's very impressive.
All I had to work with was a Steadicam, and I used like one of those refrigerator dollies if I had to do.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But,
right.
There were a lot of shots that, I mean, I watched the movie, and of course, it hurts me sometimes because I'm like, oh, I wanted this and I wanted that, but that just wasn't in the budget. And but everyone really, this whole the city I shot it in, which is Saltillo, Mexico, they really were happy that we chose to film it here, because they had never filmed a movie here before. So every actor worked for free, and every person who was helping with lights and carrying things and food and all that stuff, they all worked for free. Most of the money was spent on food, actually.
Yeah,
that's the way it does work. That is,
feed the
crew
and keep them happy.
Yeah.
So,
how long did it take to shoot the film? What was your production schedule like?
Oh man, I'm almost afraid to say this, but it took 8 months.
Oh,
it took 8 months.
Okay, that's
well,
not.
That's,
I mean,
a long time.
It's a
for
long
me.
Time.
I mean,
but people have, you know, things. Life happens. I mean, that's understandable.
Yeah, and life happens, and money doesn't.
Yeah.
So you shoot when you can.
Yeah.
Well, the fact that all the actors were working for free. You know, and I didn't know. We did a casting, an open casting. And,
oh, okay.
Like 400 people were lined up outside, just waiting. And this is professional actors and non-professional actors. And I actually decided to go with non-professional actors. And we decided to pay for a class for some real actors to come in
and we rehearsed for a week all of their parts and gave them acting classes for a whole week. It was pretty intense, and it ended up working out really well for us. And the only real the actor that we had that had some experience was theatrical experience was Monica Almanza, which I killed in the second story, the first 30 minutes, so it didn't matter anyway.
Right. So tell me, you said you've been teasing us for a while. You said something about, on our anniversary show, I think, something about an encounter with Edgar Wright.
Oh, yeah.
During the yeah. Spill the beans, man.
Well, this is to me, this is like a great story for me, personally. But we were filming, if you in the film, you've seen that there was a pretty intense club scene with hundreds
yes.
of actors in there. And it was just a whole week of just headaches and just shooting like really fast and nonstop, and I was tired. I was really dead tired. And I got to that point where you're just like, wow, am I going to be able to finish this? Am I going to be able to pull this off? I don't even have the energy, you know? Like, I can't walk. You know, I can't even, you know, to say action hurts me right now. And I had the car crash scene that was coming up, and the ambulance and the cops
mm-hmm.
and all that. And I was just like, wow, I still got so much to do. And that morning, I got an email from Edgar Wright. And
ooh.
And he said, hey, I'm in Mexico. Hot Fuzz was opening up down here. He said, I'm in Mexico for the premiere of Hot Fuzz. Here's my phone number. Why don't you call me? I'll have someone from Universal come and pick you up. You know, and I'm all tired, you know, and I'm like seeing things, so I just call my wife into the room, I'm like, did I just get an email from Edgar Wright? You know, I couldn't believe it, you know? And it really energized me. Unfortunately, I couldn't go, because I told him, you know, I said, man, it's an honor that you even wrote me. I you don't know what this means to me. I mean, imagine it's like your favorite, you know, imagine if Al Pacino wrote you an email.
I know, man.
Here's my favorite director who sends me this email, and then I said, here's my cell phone number. I said, if you're going to be in Mexico for longer, as soon as I shoot this scene, I'll get on a plane and I'll go out there and we'll hang out. And he emailed me back and said, you know what, I fly out tomorrow. He said, you know, and I said, okay, well, thanks anyway. Well, anyway, I'm shooting the cop scene. Now I'm all energized up. You know, I just got an email from my favorite director. And Edgar's such a great person. He takes it one step further, and he calls me. And he wishes me luck on my shoot.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, yeah, and wishes me luck on my shoot. When we talk for about 5-10 minutes or something, and then I get back to it. And that really gave me the energy to continue the rest of the chaotic scenes that I had coming up. So, I mean, kudos
that's
to
a dream. That's
Edgar
a yeah,
Wright
that's an absolute... That's an absolute dream, man. So
and it says a lot about someone who will take time like that, take time out of their day, make that phone call to a fan, you know. And it says a lot about him. And everyone who's listening, if they don't know who Edgar Wright is and they don't know who Spaced is, what Spaced is, it's coming out on DVD.
Yeah, I can't
okay,
wait for it
next
to come
week,
out.
This Tuesday, I think it comes out, and they need to go get it.
Yeah.
They need to go buy it because they're going to have commentaries by Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith, Diablo Cody, just to name a few. So get out there and get your space set.
Yeah, it's going to be incredible.
That's my Edgar Wright plug.
Yeah. So tell me about the fever to see your film once it was completed. Did you guys do a lot of press to promote it, or when did you sense this buzz in the air about being able to see this film?
The buzz started right when I came on board, and we did a casting, and then 400 people showed up, and
right,
and it was just like nonstop. We were on the TV, we were on the radio, and I remember thinking like, "What the hell's going on? How did I get here?" You know, and and then once we got the movie finished, and it's been a crazy press tour all over, and I mean we opening night, we didn't even have enough. We had to send hundreds home, you know.
Mm.
And in the theater, just like aisles were filled. in the aisles. You know, people weren't even in there. People filled the seats, and then, you know, we were putting them in the aisles. Thank goodness that there's no, you know, fire hazard laws here in Mexico, so they just pack them in there, you know. And you know, unfortunately, we turned people away, but the buzz is insane. I can't even. Just this week, it played in Colombia and in Venezuela for several thousand people. So it's going, and to me, it just seems like a dream come true. And I'm, you know,
yeah.
I'm happy to see it done, see it completed, see it on the big screen. And opening night, premiere night, you know, you can go to YouTube and type in Cuotas on the Campeón or just type in my name, and there's some videos up there of
the video of you guys attending the opening of it, and you guys are also giddy. I mean, it's a terrific video.
The videos you posted on your blog are great, the ones I've seen so far. So,
yeah, sometimes I'll put up, like, TV interviews. And I have this really hard problem of just standing still.
I noticed that.
If you've seen any of those TV interviews, I act crazy sometimes. I can't stand still for very long, so I don't know if TV interviews is the best thing for me. But it's been the hype here has just been great, and the response has been great. All the newspapers, I got stacks and stacks, and I'm trying to collect them all, but I can't. There's too many, and just of you know, articles and people writing up on the movie, and it's just been a dream come true, really.
So how many territories are you guys playing in? I know you said that you guys sold like 30 different territories or countries. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, we got DVD distribution right away, really fast. So it's going all over Latin America, every Latin American country, any Spanish-speaking country, it's going to open up. And we're planning on doing an opening up for DVD in the United States. We do have the English subtitles on. It's just going to take some time because there's a lot of laws you guys have. So we got to get some things cleared.
Right.
Our damn laws, man.
Yeah, aren't we stuck about laws?
With us.
Red tape.
Patient with us. So, and we're working on it. We're working hard on the DVD release, and it should be more than 4 months, I'd imagine.
Awesome.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. Do you feel like you're able
get
to
get it all done?
Do you feel like you're able to, for instance, at the premiere and everything that's come to you since you've finished the project, that you're able to enjoy this, or does it feel like an out of body experience?
I am enjoying it. I'm enjoying it. At the same time, I'm I'm working hard on the next projects, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a bit. But and I'm enjoying the whole time. And, yeah, at the same time it is. It's like you're sitting and you're like, and there's a packed house, and people are laughing at, you know, where they're supposed to laugh at, and they're, like, going at the places that they're supposed to go at. So it's like, and you sit back and you're like, is this really happening? Is this really happening, you know? And I'm like, thank God he's so good to me, you know, and because that's, you know, it's crazy.
So tell us about the next project. What are your ambitions for that one?
Well, I got several cut now. In January, I start filming a TV series, which came about after the movie. But I had actually filmed a pilot of a TV show I had in my mind. Me and my wife actually wrote it, and we filmed it for like $50, just a pilot. And now we're going to go ahead. We got the okay to film a whole series, and that's called My Church, and it's about a con man who works his way into a church for the money and stuff like that.
Wow.
And so it's going to be an interesting TV show. And then but the next movie is called Painting Pictures, and I'm really, really excited about starting filming that, because we're taking it all a whole new level, taking it up a new level. And I don't know. It's going to be awesome. I guess the only thing I can say right now about the script is, if I have to kind of sum it up, it's about a mentally like handicapped person who all his life has been this way. And then when he turns 30, he gets in a car accident. And when he wakes up in the hospital, he slowly gets the abilities that he's never had in life.
Right.
And we walk this out with him. And I wish you, and, you know, but he gets even smarter than most people. And then it's actually kind of a weird script because it goes from action into horror and then into drama.
Yeah.
So I don't want to give away too much about it right now, but I can say that the script's taken me about 5 years to write.
So this is your own script here?
Yes, yes. This is my baby that I've been wanting to make. I got one guy signed on. He's a method actor from California. And it's going to be my first English movie as well. And his name is Benjamin Chamberlain. And he's a great actor. He just hasn't had the opportunity. He's done, like, some small stuff in Desperate Housewives and Scrubs. Nothing big. And I think he's amazing. And he loved the script, and he's on board. And then his counterpart, a girl, who I actually wrote in mind for Sarah Polley. And if you listen to this, Sarah, I'm tightening up the script for you, then I'll send it. But
Sarah listens to us all the time.
She's a big fan.
Yeah, I'm sure she does.
That's right.
Who knows?
That's right.
Who knows?
So tell me... I'm sorry, go ahead, man.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, I mean, we're about to close up. I just wanted to know from you any kind of words of wisdom, because you know that we have our listeners out there from all over in their interest and experience in filmmaking, and a lot of them are in your position before you got started on this journey. Tell me any words of wisdom to the up-and-coming filmmakers or people that want to be filmmakers out there. What would you tell them?
Well, I can give them some tips. One of them would be making films, you know. I mean, I was making these short films, these, like, 3-minute, 5-minute, 10-minute films, which landed me this, you know, this job. So, I mean, if you have an idea, go out there and film it, and just get yourself out there. The other thing is calling all the favors. I mean, I have a whole soundtrack for Corazón de Campeón. And what I did is I got on MySpace, and I just sent out an email to all the bands. I said, hey, here's the deal. I'm making a movie. I'll put your band in my movie. If I like your song, you guys will get promotion wherever we play it. And I got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of songs that came to me. And I could just choose whichever one. And I'm very thankful for all the bands that entered in, you know. And I chose, I wouldn't say the six or seven best songs, but the ones that I felt really complimented the movie, you know.
Sure.
With the internet out there, use the internet. Man, there are people out there. The guy who scored my movie, he's a guy out in the Monterey, his name was Eric Pizzina, and he was just waiting for this opportunity one day for someone to get, he did an amazing score for my movie. And I said, I have no money to pay you, everyone's working for free, this is what I'm doing, are you in? And he said, I'm in, you know? So utilize the internet out there, because there's a lot of people out there who have the passion, have the desire, but they may never get that opportunity. And I felt like this movie right here was all about opportunities. And it was my opportunity, it was all the actors' opportunities. This is everyone's first gig, and it turned out amazing, because they all had, I would just look for people with passion. If you find people with passion and want to do it, I mean, there are I want to make movies that when you walk out, you feel different, you know? Like when you watch Rocky, you feel like you could take on the world. Or if you watch Rambo, you feel like you could kill an army with a toothpick, you know? Or, you know, and who wasn't a kid who just watched Star Wars who didn't try to see if the Force worked, you know? Like those movies that
still
make
trying
you feel
to do that.
What's that?
Still trying to do that.
Still trying to pull off the Force. It doesn't work.
The mind trick just doesn't work on the boss, though. I mean, I'll tell you, it just doesn't.
And there's movies out there, you know, that inspire, like, you know, The Count of Monte Cristo or The Fugitive, you know, or Awakening. It's movies like that where you just go, man, you know, that I want to make movies that inspire people, that change people, that, you know. And the only way you're going to do that is to find a team that has passion.
Mm-hmm.
Passion and a love for film, you know, for what they do, you know. And I've been watching films for a while. You know, the first film I ever seen was Cheech and Chong Up in Smoke. I remember I was a kid.
That was the first film you ever saw?
That's the first movie I've ever seen.
Oh, man, that's got to be wild. I love that movie, but wow. That's your first film. Wow.
This is the first film. And then my second film, and I'm like a kid, but my mom loved horror movies. But the only thing is she couldn't watch them alone. So she would make me watch them with her. My second movie was Jaws. And I still can't get in the water to this day. I mean, you know, that's how much Jaws changed my life, you know. And then, you know, there's other movies like The Fly, The Birds, Big Trouble in Little China, Temple of Doom, you know, just all these movies that for some reason have formed who I am. Because movie making is such a powerful, powerful art. It can just shape and mold a person, you know. And yeah. I want to inspire people. And so that's all, I say all that for the passion part. Find people who have a passion, find actors who have passion, who aren't afraid to put in a 15-hour day, you know, to make sure that scene, that they fill that scene, you know. So that's what I'd say.
I think the key word is passion, and it's the key word that we've always used for this show and our feeling about movies, too. So, Joel, you're a tremendous inspiration and a hell of a filmmaker, and I can only imagine the stuff that we're going to see from you in the future. You're gonna be a major player, my friend.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you guys just giving me the time to come on your show. I love the show, and you know, I'm a fan first, and then I'm a director second. You know.
Just, hey, well, thank you. We love having you on. I mean, definitely.
So, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Joel. And you're gonna come back whenever your film is available for our listeners here in the States.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. When we do a DVD press conference up there in the States, and you guys will be the first ones
to get
the scoop. So,
thank you so much, buddy.
I
appreciate everything you do for us.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll see you. Thanks.
All right.
Bye, man. That's Joel Valley. His movie is called Corazón de Campeón.
And it's a really good movie, folks.
It's very
really
good. Very good. Very good. Very confident. You say the title now, Jerry.
I'm not even going to embarrass myself.
Corazón de Campeón.
Corazón de Campeón.
That's probably better than I did. But I wanted to read something. We're going to, for the last 5 minutes of the show here, we're going to bring on Aaron because he has a very special announcement to make. But I found something. I searched through the internet for us all the time. I found a review. Someone with a very popular blog site, called Celluloid Notes.
Mm-hmm.
He's been listening to the show, and you can find it at celluloidnotes.com, I believe. It's actually a fantastic site that's very, like us, very passionate about films.
Right.
He wrote a review of our podcast.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
Read it, and then let's bring on Aaron, but read it, please.
Yeah, let me tell you. Movie Geeks is a show that varies greatly. From geekish musings on what is in the cinema currently to director interviews and tribute shows. I've been somewhat new to this program, but have been listening to it frequently lately and thought that it was a good podcast that needs to be highlighted. I'm going to read it, you know, all of it, the good and bad.
Okay.
It's often pretty lo-fi, plagued by bad cell phone reception, trouble with uploads, like the recent Chris Carter episode, rampant use of the phrase gangbusters, that's me.
Oh, God, but
some hokey, some hokey jokes, that's me also. But it also adds to the podcast charm, spending an equal amount of time chatting about recent blockbusters like Hancock or Wall-E and on hidden gems like Dear Zachary or The Whackness. They say the style of the interviews, low-key and has a certain earnestness to the question. You never sense that this is our job, because, of course, we don't get paid a cent for it. or that we feel like it's a sense of obligation. We have a fan, and it's always very nice to, you know,
that's beautiful.
Essentially what I'm getting to. And I appreciate the write-ups that our fans do for the show and all the support you guys have given us.
Thank you.
And honest support, too. I mean, he was very honest and about what he feels about our podcast, and we really appreciate that. I mean, constructive criticism goes a long way with us.
Yeah, it does.
If anyone out there has any comments, suggestions, questions for us, you can email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. And with that, let's bring on Aaron. That's a special announcement. I wish I had some special music to introduce you, Aaron. But I don't. Hello, Aaron.
Hey, what's up, fellas?
Hey, what's up?
Hey, buddy.
Hey, I love that review. That review was gangbusters.
Okay.
quick, so you know, that was a good review.
It was very nice to read. It was a very nice surprise when I searched for it the other day. So you have a very special thing to announce on the show tonight, and it concerns another show, which happens to be your own.
That is correct. I will be starting come Thursday. I shall be launching my own show called Back by Midnight. It'll be a talk show dedicated to all things home entertainment. DVDs, everything, obviously DVDs and Blu-ray, but formats and any new technological breakthrough that will come through. Our first show will be, as you said, Thursday. It'll be at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central Time. It'll be a roundtable discussion with noted DVD home entertainment critics, particularly Glenn Kinney, of formerly of Premiere.com and now of SomeCameRunning.com, and of the noted and very esteemed Laserdisc critic, now DVD critic, Douglas Pratt, who's just one of the giants in DVD reviewing. And then after that, we shall see what we should see. I have negotiations with guests that will come on talking about DVD releases, whether it be the director, the producer, the actor, or anyone associated with the production of the actual DVD. Keep looking forward to that. You can find out updates. I'll start posting updates on my own blog, which is www.movielove.blogspot.com. That's my own blog.
Movie Love, okay.
Movie Love, okay.
.blogspot.com. Okay, we'll put that in the chat room now. And your show airs, when is it again?
Thursday, July 24th. At 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central.
Okay.
So. Make sure. I didn't spell it right. Hang on. I'm terrible at holding the phone and typing at the same time.
Yeah, that's cool. And it's called Back by Midnight in honor of that dying ritual. I guess it is now a dying ritual of going to the video store and renting videos. It's kind of weird that now even renting videos is kind of an arcane thing now with Netflix. Right? I think we all can attest to when we were younger kids, you know, going every Friday or Saturday night and renting 2, 3, 4 tapes for the weekend.
Yeah.
They all had to be back by midnight on a certain date.
That's right. I rented.
And of course, they were never. And also, I was going to name the show Be Kind Rewind, but that obviously was taken.
Yeah. So Thursday night, be on the lookout for that. I'm here on Blog Talk Radio. Our good friend Aaron starting his own show, and we want to be very supportive of that show, and it sounds like it's going to be a great time with great guests, and I've heard what you have planned, so we're really looking forward to it.
Let me just add that this does not mean I am cutting my ties to Movie Geeks United. I shall be returning when possible, when I can be fit in the schedule, which is always crowded, and I'll be providing the DVD reviews of big titles as they come along, but also cross-promoting with my own show.
So
I shall be back.
Thank you for the warning.
All right, dude. Good luck with the show, Aaron.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Absolutely, man. We are going to close out now. We thank everyone for joining us for the past hour and 40 minutes. It's been a blast. Go see The Dark Knight if you haven't yet. Go see Corazón de Campeón if it's anywhere near you. And we will see you back here Wednesday for a jam-packed tribute to Jaws. You don't want to miss that. Don't want to miss it. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun tonight.
Yeah, it was. Goodbye, guys.
Good night, guys.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.